you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Jay Dyer. Jay, how you doing?
Great, Tim. How are you?
Great. Listen, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Sure.
And, of course, you are the host of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com, the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. And I believe you're also working on a new TV show. Is it Hollywood Decoded?
It is, yes. Jay Wiedner and I have that pretty much wrapped up, the first 17 episodes, and then we've got some other great people, Katie and Sid, working in the background, and we're looking to shoot that in the next couple weeks, and then I'm guessing a month or two later it'll be released on Gaia.
Okay, great. So you're keeping busy?
I was really busy for, I haven't been super busy the last couple weeks, but the month before that, I was really busy. It was a lot more work than, I'm not bitching. I'm happy to be doing it. You know, it's, I can't imagine anything more fun than, you know, being a thinner version of Roger Ebert, maybe a little more insane than Roger Ebert, more on the crazy side. That sounds like super fun to me. So to me, it's kind of like, you know, high school dream. This is what we dreamed of doing, is, you know, making fun of movies or something, or talking about film. So yeah, we're looking forward to that. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, it beats working in a cubicle.
Yes, thank God.
Great. Well, okay. Well, tonight I invited you back on because you've done a number of analyses that I found particularly interesting in the past month. One was your take on this Vault 7 leak. I know it's been a few weeks, but it's still very interesting. And then you did an interesting analysis of Malachi Martin's Keys of This Blood.
Right.
But first, of course, we had the passing of David Rockefeller in the past couple weeks. Any observations on the life of David Rockefeller, and what was his significance in your mind?
Well, it did prompt me to kind of pull out my old version of Memoirs, which is his book that chronicles his adventures and misadventures. And if we look at page 250, I don't know if the pictured pages aren't numbered, but I think the pictures of him with Nikita Khrushchev and Zhu Enlai are very telling. He's hanging out with all these communists, and
well, he was obviously an ambassador for peace. He was reaching out to the other side.
Sure, sure, right. But this is in the '60s, right? I mean, this is the height of the Cold War, and everybody's laughing and smiling, and you know, having cigars and so forth. And you know, then we move over to him lauding and praising Nelson Mandela. All kinds of strange things in this book, which, you know, there's a whole chapter, page 258, I've read quite a bit of it. I haven't read the entire thing, but I've read quite a bit of it, and it's pretty marked up. And, he talks about this open door policy. So it wasn't Nixon. Nixon, of course, was just sort of the front man, but it was, David who got the, this open door policy supposedly up and running.
I thought Nixon ordered Kissinger to go to China and play ping pong or something. So there's some deeper intrigue to all this, huh?
Well, it looks like David was behind a lot of this, and that's not surprising. He had the money, and as you pointed out, he could fly into Moscow, it appears, when he saw fit. And then we get to the famous quote, you know, chapter 27. A lot of people say that I am not a populist, that I'm working as part of a global cabal for a global government. He says, I'm proud to admit that. And he talks about the setting up the CFR, and then he talks about the Bilderberg Group, and all of that is really, you know, chapter 27 of the memoirs, I think, is probably sums up the entire book, the whole, all the networks. And, you know, what we learn is that this is really just, this is who runs the global government. You know, I'm not saying him alone, but, you know, he's one of the key players. So,
yeah.
You know, the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, the CFR, the ecumenism, you know, all of this is really coming out of this family, this oligarchic family. You know, they donated the land for the United Nations, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So that's my retrospective. And, you know, I guess I would say we only have one life here. And if we're going to meet our maker, you know, what does Jesus say? Jesus says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul?
Yep.
Well, that's my retrospective.
I think the Rockefellers saw themselves, David Rockefeller and the Rockefellers in general saw themselves, I think the term is justified sinners, because they were so important that they transcended the normal moral constraints of the hoi polloi, the general population, and they're that far above them. If he passed away or he was uploaded by Ray Kurzweil to to some computer somewhere, and now he's hanging out with
I've got him on my zip drive.
Yeah, he's flirting with the voice of Scarlett Johansson or something. I don't know. From her. Yeah. You know,
maybe they've merged into one super entity.
Yeah. And I was listening. I guess, you know, the whole idea of AI, you know, that's, I mean, to you, is that like, it's just like a repackaged idea of the golem, you know, the sort of this.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's nothing ever changes. Right?
Well, all these bots, you know, cybernetics, and the idea of having a slave class of bots. Well, that's just the golem. I mean, the golem is the mythical creature that you tell him what to do, and he goes and he digs the holes in the field. He pulls out the weeds.
Yeah.
he's your slave bot. So,
well, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, what was really in David Rockefeller's heart. Cause I think he had like six or seven of them put in his body by the time he passed.
You would think that maybe he got the heart of somebody with, you know, compassion perhaps.
I'm joking, but. Yeah, so, you know, well, so he's the passing of David Rockefeller, 101 years old. From what I understand, he always had trouble reading because he went to that new Lincoln School or something that was a progressive school.
Well, I heard you discuss that in one of the interviews that you guys were talking about that. And I'm not saying that's not true, but I know in his memoirs he talks about he did a dissertation, I guess it would be his master's, on von Hayek. And he talked about how influenced by von Hayek he was. So I don't know what to make of that. Obviously, he was able to do reading, but yeah, it's probably true that he probably didn't care for it.
He never enjoyed it. That was the thing there.
Yeah,
it was a chore for them because the way they were taught. I guess that would have been the third generation, John D. Jr.'s kids. I guess there was Winthrop,
yeah.
Nelson. Was it Lawrence mm-hmm. and David? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
So, the great Pat. He's saying, does he have an heir? I
can't remember, but if you remember there's one interesting part in the authorized biography that Collier and Horowitz wrote, where one of the daughters, probably, I guess it would be David's sister, either his sister or his aunt, she thought she was a reincarnated Egyptian daughter of a pharaoh.
Hmm.
And she got this because she went and talked to Carl Jung. I'm not joking.
Oh, yeah.
She seriously thought she was a reincarnated.
Carl Jung.
So maybe they, you know, that's the only kind of occult type of connection I could find.
Carl Jung, was he the guy who like came up with the idea of like collective consciousness and all that?
Archetypes and.
So that's, forth. But that's just, that's like, that's like, that's, isn't it like Freemasonry then?
I mean, Jungian psychoanalysis is influenced by Gnosticism.
Yeah.
And yes, there are many elements of Jung that could tie into that. I mean, insofar as Masonry does have Gnostic elements, but I mean, it just depends because I don't think Carl Jung was a big fan of Masonry. He favored probably a more pagan type of approach because I think he liked Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
And so most Nazis don't like Freemasonry because they see it as Judaic, and then they tend to favor these more pagan ideas. So Carl Jung could call Freud the more Judaic
yes
approach, and then Carl Jung would be the more pagan Nazi approach.
Yeah, the psychoanalyst approach is kind of a Judaic black op against Christian society. I guess that's one way to look at it. I guess.
Well, but what I'm saying is that Carl Jung's, it's still psychoanalysis, but it's not, he differs heavily from his mentor, Freud,
mm-hmm.
because he believed all this esoteric stuff, or at least he claims to, Freud didn't believe any of that stuff. Freud was just a materialist and a, you know, atheist or whatever.
Yeah. I think Freud just wanted to screw a lot of people up and make money doing it. And that was, there's a famous, writing a letter to his friend. His friend's inviting Matt, I think, up north because he's in Vienna, on vacation. And he says he fears in my absence, my patients will get better. So, mm-hmm. so he doesn't want to go on vacation. That's why, you know. So that's Freud. But well, anyway. So you did this thing on Vault 7. Made quite a splash.
Oh, by the way, I'm sorry. Real quick. Here's what I was looking for. This is page 73 of the Collier and Horowitz. This authorized biography, by the way, David Horowitz. And it's this would be his David's aunt, I believe. Edith moved to Chicago and adopted a regal style. One time she even wore a $2 million string of pearls, and the next time she wore a $1 million string of emerald necklace. Her father might have tolerated her simple ostentation. It was her extramarital affairs and peculiar intellectual predilections that embarrassed him. She became fanatically involved in psychoanalysis and studied under Carl Jung for several years, and then returned to America to claim that this new art would allow her to cure tuberculosis and other diseases. There's our snake oil salesman here.
Yeah.
She gravitated towards astrology and reincarnation and claimed that she was the reappearance of Akhen Asen Paaten, the child bride of Pharaoh. So there you go. That's Edith. However she is. His mom or his mama.
Yeah, I think Edith was the mother because...
Edith was.
Yeah, I think Edith was David's mother, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
I might be mistaken.
Edith Rockefeller, parents.
Because John D. Jr.
Yes,
John,
she is the...
Is that Aldrich's, Senator Aldrich's daughter?
John D. Rockefeller is the father of Edith Rockefeller McCormick. She married a McCormick.
Okay, that's okay. There you go.
So John D. and Laura Spellman had her, so that would make her what, David's sister or aunt? I'm still confused. Cousins, grandparents.
That would be his aunt.
Okay.
Because David was the son of John Jr. Right? Yeah. David Nelson,
okay.
Lawrence, okay. And Winthrop. So that would be his aunt, okay. Okay, I see. Okay. And yeah, the McCormick, because that's what the McCormick Reaper Company, I guess, that family. Another oligarchical family.
The McCormick what?
The McCormick Reaper Company. Is that who that is?
I don't know.
It's got it. Yeah, I think they did marry into that family. So,
who is this? What do they do?
You know, McCormick.
I don't.
The big McCormick. I think they were harvesting machinery, mechanized farming.
Oh, farming stuff. Okay.
Yeah. I think so. I'm just if I can remember that properly.
Well, is this the big company McCormick.com, like where you get your spices in the grocery, the spice rack?
It might be linked to that. I'm not sure about that, but I know I think they're based out of, if I'm not mistaken, Chicago. But yeah, they were big into the mechanized reapers, McCormick Reaper, I think, but revolutionized farm. I guess would have been the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they married in that family, but I could be mistaken. I'm just going by memory.
Okay.
So, and I could be misremembering, as they say. So, okay. Well, Vault 7. You did an analysis of that, and it made quite a splash. And it wasn't so revelatory because we kind of already knew it. But it's important, in at least giving us some detail and spelling out the details and the depth of the surveillance state. So, let's talk about Vault 7.
Yeah, I think what was interesting here was, you know, we're getting these things kind of every few years, you know, where we get the Snowden, the week that we get the Assange, and then we get the Snowden, then we get more Assange. And, you know, as we said many times, we shouldn't necessarily take leaks at face value. We should assume that leaks generally have some kind of political motivation behind them. And it looked like the Podesta emails and the WikiLeaks leaks during the campaign were obviously targeted for the aid of Trump, and then Trump wins. And then we get more of this, which we're told, oh, this was supposed to be targeted at the CIA and this was going to damage the CIA and all this, which, you know, didn't really do anything because it didn't get a lot of mainstream coverage. Less so than the original, you know, Podesta emails type stuff coverage, but because it was forced into, you know, part of the campaign drama. And then Vault 7 had hardly any.
Hey, Jay.
Drudge Report and that kind of stuff. But,
hey, Jay. You
know, none of the mainstream coverage.
Hey, Jay. Hey, can I give you a call back? Yep. I'm see if I can get a better connection. Yeah. Can I give you a call back so I can get a better connection?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to record again. Okay, so, sorry, we broke off there. Vault 7, you were talking about how we get these glimpses into the surveillance state. And like the Snowden leak, I think it was where you kind of cut off your
target. Okay.
Okay.
Right, and of course, as we know, you know, these things don't really change anything, but they kind of have a targeted, limited usage, limited hangout type thing. Doesn't mean the information is false per se. The information in all of these cases appears to be real, but it's not really new, so to speak. And I think that's why we have to have a skeptical attitude to the mainstream story about these leaks and leak engines and whistleblowers and that kind of stuff, which we've talked about and covered many times. I tend to think that Snowden was not a legitimate whistleblower and he has a legend and a cover and all that kind of stuff. And that doesn't mean, though, that when we look at the Vault 7 information, that it's necessarily false. It has the appearance of being legitimate. These are real statements of capabilities on the part of the CIA. And it's just another layer, another level of the abilities of the establishment to do things like, in this case, be able to spoof hacking. So what is claimed to be Chinese and Russian hackers can actually be a CIA run op that spoofs, giving the appearance of it coming out of China or Russia. Now, that does not mean that China or Russia are good guys. There are, I'm sure, groups of hackers in every country who have no qualms or morals, but it does lead one to think that, well, you know, the development of the internet itself is out of the Pentagon, so it's probably a lot of these kind of people in the Silicon Valley people who are behind a lot of these so-called search engine browser safety programs and the faulty software. And then we've had people at, like, there was the accusation that, I believe, Kaspersky Labs, that one of the people at Kaspersky Labs was supposed to be Russian, was a CIA guy or something to this effect, or it was the other way around. It's a CIA thing, and one of the guys was a Russian agent or something to this effect. I don't know, but this ties into Vault 7 somehow. And really, it's the main point to understand from the Vault 7 stuff is just that it backs up the arguments that what we were being told for so long about the Russian agent narrative is not true. And Trump's actions yesterday with the strike in Syria pretty clearly, I think, show you that we're correct in all that. We might have our optimism about Trump it looks to be waning and is looking pretty dark, but we were correct when it came to the assessment of him not being a Russian agent. that doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And that was really, I think, what the strong point of Vault 7 was demonstrating that, and to demonstrate that that they were wiretapping, that they were surveilling. It's blackmail. It's all the stuff that you and I've talked about, and the people that you've interviewed so many times have talked about. This is the recurring pattern, the recurring theme that we're seeing. So that's really, I think, the strong point of Vault 7. And it shows that the real NSA is not necessarily a building in Maryland or wherever, that even if that was to be shut down, which is not ever going to happen, but even if theoretically that were shut down, you know, you still got these giant underground AT&T complexes. You've got, Verizon and all these different companies, which have been shown in Bamford's books to already have been connected to large-scale surveillance and the backdoor technology that we've seen, the ProMIS technology, the InsLaw Octopus article from years ago, Crossing the Rubicon, has many chapters on ProMIS by what's his name?
Mike Rupert.
Rupert. And and I was looking back at some of Bamford's books from a long time ago, you know, 1982, 83, Puzzle Palace. They were talking about all this stuff. So if you've read any of Bamford's stuff or Shadow Factory from 4 or 5 years ago, this is all old hat. None of this is new, but it's new to the mainstream, to the mass audience. And, you know, it has obviously a political usage, political motivation. But, you know, it just shows you that we're being lied to on massive, gigantic scale when it comes to what the purpose of all this tech stuff is. You know, it's to create a giant spy grid.
Yes, panopticon, if you will.
Yeah. Sure.
Panopticon. One of the early indications of that for me was about 10 years ago when Mark Klein talked about, he was an AT&T technician. He talked about how the telecommunication companies were just swooping up all this information in collusion with the intelligence community.
If you watch the movie Enemy of the State, he'll talk about that being the case. The Gene Hackman character, who's this former NSA guy, mm-hmm. and that movie came out in 1998. He tells the Will Smith character that the telecommunications companies were in bed with the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies from the get-go. And if you read John Marks's book, there's a section where he talks about Bell Labs and private intelligence, that Bell set up their own private intelligence before the CIA. So from the get-go, and I think Bamford mentions that at some point too, you're absolutely right.
And IBM, you know, its growth in the second half of the 20th century was largely based on government contracts and servicing the Pentagon and the intelligence community. So you can look at IBM as sort of a intelligence front, so to speak, one of the, you know, proprietary company, if you want. But
absolutely, Chris,
and you know, some think that IBM spawned Microsoft. There was a, you know, Bill Gates was a more or less a kind of a cutout to market a certain product, the same way that
that's what I tend to think. Yeah,
yeah. And the whole thing with Windows was to create a sort of a platform that would enable them to mass surveil, whether it's for intelligence, marketing, because it's all the same.
There was I had a very, very wealthy guy say to me one time, he knew a lot about all this, and he said, people talk about viruses on their computer. He said, Windows is a virus.
Yeah, it's not a virus, it's a feature, yeah.
And he meant as a spying virus is what he meant.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's called Windows, for Pete's sake.
Good point.
I mean, it's just like Intel. I think people point out that it's Intel inside.
Intel inside, right. Yeah. Intelligence companies with a back door inside, yeah. Have you read Crossing the Rubicon?
Yes, I have. Yeah. It was my first kind of like, maybe 6-7 years ago, and kind of like reading all this stuff, and yeah.
Do you remember the sections on the ProMis software and all that?
That's interesting, because the ProMis software story is so, I mean, it's the octopus, and that's the death of Danny Castellaro in West Virginia. He cut his wrist, supposedly, in a hotel there. And how it was stolen from Inslaw, the Hamiltons, and it was then given to all these foreign national, you know, all these other governments, because it had this backdoor technology into it. I would have to seem to think that, you know, if you're a foreign intelligence agency and you're getting software, wouldn't you be sophisticated enough to suspect that there might be a backdoor? But again, I don't know.
I would think so. Wasn't there some accusation along those lines with Indira Singh and the 9/11? Yeah.
P-TECH, and that's part of the, because that gave them access into all these, and you know how FAA responded. It might explain the stand down. It might explain why everyone's screen was full of imaginary planes. Everyone couldn't tell what was real or what wasn't. To confuse the issue, and who would have had that capability? Yes. P-TECH was owned by the Saudi, and you know, so it's Indira Singh's revelations. One other interesting intrigue that is the I was talking to Dr. Joseph Farrell about that. And he seemed to suggest that the one of the intrigues of the Robert Hansen spy case was he passed ProMis software along. Now, if you understand what ProMis software was, it was to give to people so our intelligence community could have a backdoor into their programs. That shines a different light on why he would give that away, supposedly.
Interesting.
He was suggesting
possibly he was a double agent, or maybe he didn't know what he was giving away.
Or it's like I said, it might be something like what Shackley did to Ed Wilson or something, set him up. Mm-hmm. Or you never know. Are you suggesting deeper intrigue to this stuff? He said, well, very possibly, because then all of a sudden now he's arrested for this, espionage with the Russians and these things, but he's involved in this ProMis software. At the time, it was reported as if he'd given it to Al-Qaeda or something. Al-Qaeda got a hold of it because he gave it to the Russians, but now, look at the intrigues of the whole ProMis software case, where it's this backdoor technology. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's the same way it is with Silicon Valley and giving everyone iPhones and gadgets. Mm-hmm. Because all these operating systems have back doors on them, and there is no real resistance by the telecommunications company or the computer companies.
No, not at all.
There was a actually, I have a quote here.
And some people have made the accusation that it's installed at the factory level, like at the hardware level.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's true, but I've seen articles say that.
But if you look at Silicon Valley, it grew out of the the national security state.
Yeah, this is I've talked about that too for a long time. I don't buy that this was like a big free market thing. That's a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, The Primacy of Security Theater by Bill Blunden. Silicon Valley sells the illusion of security, And he goes, certainly large high-tech companies care about quarterly earnings. That definitely explains all the tax evasion, wage ceilings, and slave labor. But these same companies would be hard-pressed to actually protect user privacy because spying on users is a fundamental part of their business model. Like government spies, corporate spies collect and monetize oceans of data. Furthermore, high-tech players don't need to actually bulletproof their products to win back customers. It's far more cost-effective to simply manufacture the perception of better security, slap on some crypto, flood the news with public relation pieces, and get some government officials, example given James Comey, Robert Hannigan, Stuart Baker, to whine visibly about the purported enhancements in order to lend the marketing campaign credibility. The techno-libertarians of Silicon Valley are masters of security theater. That was a great quote. But the whole here's a explain why this is the way it is. Your business interests having lured customers in droves with a myriad of false promises will go back to secretly cooperating with government spies, as they always have, introducing subtle weaknesses in their cryptographic protocols, designing backdoors that double as accidental zero-day bugs, building rootkits which hide in plain sight, and handing over user data. In other words, all the behavior that was described by Edward Snowden's documents, like the jilted lover, consumers will be pacified with a clever sales pitch that conceals the deeper corporate subterfuge. Ultimately, yep. It's a matter of shared class interests. The private sector almost always cooperates with the intelligence services because American spies pursue the long-term prerogatives of the neoliberal capitalism, open markets, and access to resources the world over. Or perhaps someone has forgotten the taped phone call of Victoria Nuland selecting the next prime minister of Ukraine as the IMF salivates over austerity measures. President of the United States caters to his constituents, the corporate ruling class, which transitively convey their wishes to the clandestine services like the CIA. Recall Edward Snowden's open letter to Brazil. These programs were never about terrorism. They're about economic spying, social control, diplomatic manipulation. They're about power. So whatever Edward Snowden is, I think that quote is still worthwhile.
Right, yeah, you know? Exactly. And do you remember the movie from 1980 or 92, Sneakers?
Robert Redford and Brad Pitt, right?
If you remember, it's about a backdoor box, a little piece of technology that can break the encryption and have a backdoor into any computer system.
And you mentioned
the way that they get the guy to engage in the transfer of this quote black box is they tell him that we've got to keep it from the Russians. So they kind of lie to this guy and they say, oh, we know who you are. We'll wipe out your record. I think it's like a criminal record. Mm-hmm. And they say, we'll wipe it out. But if you got to help us get this secret tech from the Russians.
Yeah. And also you mentioned your talk, that old movie, with Gene Hackman, The Conversation.
Yeah, we're going to, that's actually going to be in one of our episodes. Yeah. So I have to do a bunch of research on that. And what's neat about that is that it came out right around the time of Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
So the wiretapping was a big, big, big story. And I almost want to say it came out a month or two before, maybe it was a month or two after. But then you start noticing, well, actually, Manchurian Candidate, that came out before JFK was assassinated.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So and that ends with, you know, the main character, you know, setting up his sniper rifle. He's going to take out the president so that the vice president can take the take the office.
Mm-hmm. Now, with telecom and the internet, and you know, it's called a web, and you know, the web. What do webs do? They trap. They trap prey. So mm-hmm. I mean, the World Wide Web. There's a spider somewhere. So, but a good example of that, or at least what. If people are skeptical about this, is that if you look at InQtel, the CIA has its own venture capital company. You know,
they have many. Yeah, well, InQtel, and then InQtel starts or is involved in tons of tech startups, like Palantir.
Yeah.
The Peter Thiel thing is directly connected to InQtel and many, many others.
And Facebook, I think, is indirectly linked to InQtel.
Yep. Yeah, and that's vaguely hinted at in the. In the movie, Social Network, where they get this back door, this shady backroom funding in one brief scene. They don't really tell you in the movie who that is, but absolutely.
And I was reading this article by Inkutel, and they had a quote by this investment banker, or professor at Harvard Business School. He goes, "Josh Lerner, an investment banker professor at Harvard Business School, says that the liquidity crisis in venture capital has made venture firms eager to draw Inkutel in as a partner. Funds are increasingly looking to other less traditional investors to fund portfolio firms, including Inkutel, even if their ultimate objectives may be quite different from the venture capitalist's goal of maximizing the rate of return." So just throw, you know, you have the CIA, which it has a, you know, virtually a limited amount of money at its disposal because it, you know, mm-hmm. whether, you know, gets it through the drug trade or just from courtesy of the Federal Reserve. And mm-hmm. they can starve the capital markets and pretty much draw everyone in just through contrived austerity or scarcity, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
yeah. Once you understand that it's a corporate thing, and that corporate and the government, private public sector are basically the same thing. It doesn't really matter. It's a revolving door, and then you understand that it's about gaming the markets and stealing technology and blackmailing people. Then the terror mythology kind of melts away.
Mm-hmm. What was that report out of Switzerland? The Network of Global Corporate Control, I think, came out like 6 years ago. And
yes, in fact, I did an article on that. Yeah, talk about a long time ago.
Pretty much all the major corporations.
They documented that if you can graph out the corporate ownership, and then it shows that there really is like a total oligarchic system. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a transnational corporations. We find that transnational corporations form a giant bow tie structure that a large portion of control flows to a small, tightly knit core of financial institutions. This core can be seen as an economic super entity that raises the new. It raises new important issues, both for researchers and policymakers. And, of course, that you could say is sort of a if you're talking about the New World Order or an Illuminati, there it is right there, right?
I mean, yeah, it is. And, you know, that's even how the movies present it. You know, it's almost like the way it's presented in the movies of this, you know, shady – cigar smoke filled room, you know, something like the Syndicate in the X-Files.
Yeah.
And it really is like that, documented. And I think whoever presented that paper, if I recall, they might have done a TED Talk. I may be misremembering, but there's an article I did on my site a long time ago on that, and I want to say that there's even a lecture or a TED Talk that the guy did. Said, hey, you know, we actually mapped this out on a computer based on the ownership. There's actual hard documented evidence of a oligarchic global government.
Mm-hmm. The world is a
business. It shouldn't be debated. Like,
yeah.
I mean, people don't, of course, go by hard evidence. It's not really what convinces people, unfortunately. But if we did live in the world where people were convinced by objective facts and hard evidence, there would be no longer any debate over, you know, the New World Order.
Mm-hmm. The world is a business. Is a business, Mr. Beale. It has mm-hmm. been since man crawled out of the slime, as they say, network. You also did a thing. You recently did a thing with Malachi Martin,
mm-hmm.
the Jesuit, former Jesuit, I guess.
Right.
His book, Keys of This Blood in the Vatican and Geopolitics.
Yeah, I read a lot of Martin throughout my 20s, and initially, when I had gotten into Catholicism, when I left Protestantism, I was very impressed with Martin because I was more naive. You know, I was 23, 24, and I kind of took him at face value. And, you know, he did have a degree of influence upon me back then in terms of leaning me in the more traditional Catholic perspective. And I got his Jesuit book and then his Keys of This Blood and Hostages of the Devil, and there's others, you know, Windswept House, and then some of these are kind of hard to get now. They're fictional and whatnot, out of print. You know, Hostage to the Devil is his account of exorcisms and whatnot. And then, but after I started reading a lot of the books, I started noticing things that just kind of didn't add up. And I don't think that means that everything Martin's saying is false or that he's lying, because he's obviously a very intelligent person. I think he was even trained in ancient Semitic languages and supposedly spoke six or seven. I don't know if that's true, but I went after I started getting a little dubious about him, and I did some more research on him, and there were accusations and what looked to be evidence of him working at the behest of certain, I think, Jewish factions. There was supposedly a payment made to him to get certain things done in Vatican II. Again, I can't verify that on that's true, but you know, researchers who seem to be pretty credible have turned up some of that information, which can be dug up on the internet if you really dig. But setting that aside, we can just look at the kind of inconsistent statements from Martin himself, where he'll, on the one hand, you know, talk about the super satanic force in the Vatican that's involved in pedophilia, and that they're the ones behind ecumenism, and ecumenism is this, you know, movement to destroy traditional Christianity. But then, you know, when it comes to John Paul II or John 23rd or Paul VI, oh, they're great guys. And yeah, they're promoting this satanic agenda, but don't worry, they're still good guys. You know, they're doing their best, you know, kind of like what we might see with people dishonest about Trump. Well, he's got a bunch of bad people around him, but he's a good guy at heart. Anyway, but so this book is, I believe, 1990, and I called it roughly, you know, a kind of a Catholic Tragedy and Hope, not because Quigley, you know, Quigley was, of course, professing Catholic, but I don't know, Quigley doesn't really know much about theology. His focus was, you know, maritime, wartime history and that kind of stuff and geopolitics. But this, Martin's an interesting character because no matter how dubious or deceptive he might have been, he was still to some degree an insider and to some degree an important figure in the role of the world, the realm of religion and Roman Catholicism. So it's relevant in that regard. And a lot of people who try to do the kind of analysis that we do and that you do and that you interview, a lot of them, I mean, E. Michael Jones would obviously be an exception, but most people don't understand the role of Catholicism. And a lot of those people have not read or don't know much about church history and that kind of stuff. So you can miss a big piece of the puzzle, a big part of the picture, if you don't know about that kind of stuff. And I don't think it's not as easy to boil it down to like, oh, well, it's a giant Jesuit conspiracy, or it's not like that, because, you know, if you read Martin's Jesuit book, he talks about the order of the Jesuits essentially being co-opted. That doesn't mean that the Jesuits were never problematic or difficult. I think the papacy had to ban the Jesuits more than once. And then, you know, they would fall in and out of favor. But what is most relevant in Martin's book, even though it's dated, but so is, of course, Tragedy and Hope, is that you have this Cold War treatise, which is what it is, a 700-page Cold War treatise coming up towards the end of the Cold War, that still plays up the concern over the Reds and the Bolsheviks and Stalin and all the communists everywhere, and how the communists have infiltrated the Vatican, the communists have taken over the Vatican, all this stuff that we're supposed to think. It's all Moscow. But then you also have these admissions that, well, it's also Wall Street. It's also the CIA. It's also the Bushes. It's also the Rockefellers. So, you know, what do we make of this? Well, he more or less admits that it's a kind of controlled dialectic and convergence, and he hangs a lot of it on this 1988 meeting at Malta, which you've done talks with Mark Hackard on the curious intelligence history of Malta, which I think is relevant here, between Gorbachev and Bush Sr. and John Paul II. And this, of course, dealt with where geopolitics would go, the world order, and convergence. And so while on the one hand Martin wants to really continue the Cold War hype, he's at the same time admitting we've kind of moved out of that, and now it's a battle for control of the New World Order between the Pope and Russia and America.
Now that's, it was interesting, because of course Martin's role in Vatican II, what was Vatican II? And I think David Wimhoff, he's written a 900-page book about it, about the CIA's infiltration of the Vatican during Vatican II through John Courtney Murray, and this gets into this whole idea of Americanism, and as you mentioned, the Cold War, this Cold War dialectic where the church itself was maneuvered or terrorized into backing or becoming subordinate to the CIA and the West in its fight against the godless communism. But this seemed this enabled the church to be penetrated in many ways, particularly through the P2 Lodge, which is a Masonic lodge, Gladio out of Italy, because Gladio stay behind groupings or armies that resorted to sort of false flag terrorism in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. In order to to manipulate the political situation in various European countries.
And that's directly connected to Lemnitzer, who's directly connected to Washington and CIA.
Yeah, I think it was Kennedy who fired Lemnitzer after Lemnitzer proposed Operation Northwards, false flag attacks here in the United States to justify an invasion of Cuba. Kennedy, you don't get fired in government; you get transferred, and he got transferred over to NATO. And that's when the Gladio period kicks up.
Yes,
exactly. So it's a whole can of worms. But like my understanding, Malachi Martin was a liberal at Vatican II, but then after Vatican II, he presented himself as a traditional Orthodox Catholic. So,
the early books of Martin. He's got one that he wrote a long time ago, and I forget something religion and God, or I forget the title of it. But he seems to have imbibed quite a bit of the liberal higher criticism and skepticism, and even at times using little g for God. So he doesn't seem to take it very seriously early on, and then we get this presentation, and maybe he had a period where he genuinely felt bad and converted, and we're supposed to believe that he was, an exorcist. And the claim is that the different priests in Hostage to the Devil, the different stories in those chapters are actually all about him. And so he says, he claims he kind of fictionalized it to hide people's identities and this kind of stuff. And so who knows? I don't know what's true and all that, but, maybe he did have some period of conversion. I don't know. But what we get in the books of Malachi Martin, and there's plenty of people who I've talked with people who claim to have dialogued with him, and so I don't really know. There's no way for me to verify any of that. I can only go by what I see him saying in his books. And yeah, he was, I believe, the assistant to John the 23rd for a period. And he was also friends with Paul VI, and of course these are the two popes who were directly involved in Vatican II. John the 23rd calls it, and then it's basically closed up and ratified and confirmed with full apostolic authority, by the way, by Paul VI. So it's very hard, in my view, to understand how this doesn't hold the weight of all the other councils, which are supposed to be considered ecumenical and normative for Catholic theology, given the fact that the language, the linguistics that are used in the introductory remarks by Paul VI for every one of the documents and the council itself, as well as his language in the closing of the council, it's not any different than any other council, right? It's supposed to have, in my view, the full apostolic authority, which individual Catholics should not have the right or duty to. You don't have the right to reject that, because again, this is just my take on it. In Roman Catholic theology, you have what's called ordinary magisterium, and this is just the normative teaching of the church outside of what's called the extraordinary magisterium. So the Pope or an ecumenical council, right, something that seems to happen every day. This is, once every century or so. And so therefore it's called extraordinary. It's not the ordinary teaching of the church. The ordinary teaching would be everything that the church has always taught, and anything contained in the magisterial documents of the past, or the scriptures, or the papal decrees that are considered to have that infallible authority. So that is what makes up normative ordinary magisterium. And my understanding is that it's supposed to have the same gift of charism, of infallibility and inerrancy. So you can't say as a Catholic that the church in any sense universally can err in the ordinary or extraordinary magisterium. So that's why I don't believe that you could can argue that Vatican II. I mean, I think you have to take it if you're a Catholic, and so many of the groups like the Society of St. Pius X who don't really want to accept it. I think it's an inconsistent position. So then, what do you do with Vatican II? Well, you know, like you said, it's either interpreted as the spirit of tradition, or it's interpreted in this sort of new ecumenical sense. But you know, that's up to the Catholics to debate. My view is that you had this long term infiltration of Roman Catholicism by forces that, like you said, you know, saw it as an impediment to what they wanted to achieve. And so you have a similar agenda amongst British imperial ideas, amongst Freemasonry, amongst materialists, amongst scientism, right? A lot of the stuff that you get out of the Royal Society, this kind of stuff, Judaism, all of these ideas and beliefs find common goal and common ground in the opposition to, as we saw in Tragedy and Hope, the removal of the older notions of empire. So Holy Roman Empire, and by extension, the office and institution of the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church, was a problem as much as the Tsar and Russian Orthodoxy or Orthodox Christianity were problematic. So both of these institutions and their state manifestations had to be either taken down or co-opted or, you know, all the above, destroyed. That's what Quigley says. Says this is what the world wars were about, removing these impediments to global government. And, you know, America, as an extension of the British Empire, and basically still just keeping the same Masonic ideology. Who cares whether you have a king or the Jeffersonian Republic? If it's all just a bunch of Masonic gobbledygook, then it's still Luciferian. So, and if you're a Luciferian rationalist deist out of the Enlightenment, you know, if you're Voltaire or you're Diderot, you don't like any of these things. All right. You don't want Russian Orthodoxy. You don't want a czar. You don't want monarchy. You don't want altar. You don't want popes. You don't want bishops. You want secular republics. And, you know, what does all that give rise to? Oligarchs, moneyed oligarchs, right? That's who funded the revolutions. That's who funded, you know, the bankers were behind all this stuff. And we've said this many times. This is what Tragedy and Hope teaches. And Martin admits this. He admits that there's this giant ecumenical monetary movement behind global government and the push for a one world religion. And, you know, it's just fascinating to me that Martin will say that ecumenism is absolutely 100% funded for that reason.
And this would be,
that's where we are.
Yeah. And it was a time when ecumenicism was considered heresy.
Yes. Well, to be fair to the, there's a little bit of ambiguity based on the term. So, for example, the oikumene is the Greek term that refers to the expanse of the empire. And this is Byzantium, in other words, because this is Greek. So you go back to the first 1,000 years of the church. For the most part, the Eastern and Western empires had a more or less common sense of faith and a common notion of what the imperium was. And then with Charlemagne, with the rise of Augustinian theology and the Carolingians and so forth, you get and the crowning of an emperor in the West. You have the beginning of the political divisions between East and West, because, you know, Byzantium saw itself as already having that role, having been the force behind the first 7/8 ecumenical councils. And then here you have the Pope in the West confirming Charlemagne as the emperor, quote, of the West. And the idea was, why do we need two emperors? It doesn't make any sense. So this is you know, the beginning of the split between East and West. And the oikumene takes on a different notion, obviously, in the West. The oikumene, the ecumenical, falls under the jurisdiction of the Pope. So this is why, for Roman Catholicism, what constitutes all, quote, ecumenical councils from this point on, it's just whatever the Pope could, you know, decides, basically. And then in the East, you don't really have the same notion. You have the continuance of the synodical decrees and many synods and councils, but they're not, because there's no more oikumene of the Byzantine Empire. especially after it falls, the notion of the word changes. So you do have, the reunion council of Florence, where there's the attempt to unite the Eastern and Western sections of professing Christianity. And ultimately, this doesn't succeed. This doesn't go very well. It doesn't happen. Eastern Orthodoxy holds Mark of Ephesus as one of the heroes for not signing on to the papal decree and so forth. But to be fair, what I'm getting at was that those are all called ecumenical meetings, right? Mm-hmm. And you have debates and you have disagreements.
This is dialogue.
This is dialogue. Yeah. This is debate. And, both sides believe they're correct. And that's actually better, I would say, than a false notion of unity. And so what we get by the late 1890s is this Swami Vivekananda, this guy who shows up walking around Chicago, supposedly, as this Hindu missionary, and his goal is to unite all the world religions, and he's this crusader, and then, it turns out he's it's not accidental that he's walking around Chicago. He's apparently got these ecumenical connections, and he calls for this World Parliament of Religions, I think 1893 or 4. So this kicks off the modern, quote, ecumenical movement, which has nothing to do with this older, Catholic Orthodox debate type term. Mm-hmm. Now the term starts to take on the notion of praxis, very closely connected to Marxism, which is the idea that through dialogue and opposing positions, we actually just meld into the synthesis, right? The Hegelian type view. And so the friction, the dialectical tension gives rise to the ultimate just sort of dissolving into one giant blob. And this is the problem for ecumenism, is that it's relativism. It doesn't continue the notion of discovering the truth or dialogue towards moving to what's correct. It's actually a kind of weaponized strategy, a philosophical sophistic trick. And this is why you could see that the big oligarchic families would see this as highly beneficial, especially if you're the Rockefellers and you are hell-bent on a world government. Well, ecumenism is just the religious version of world government. It's the movement towards world religion, and it's very obvious, if you whatever your religious views, if you believe in things like objective truth and logical fallacies and contradictions, then you start to realize that, well, even in the religious realm, it can't be the case that everything's true, right? I mean, if God exists, then it's false that he doesn't exist, right? So, I mean, you can't have everything being true and everything being false. It's just meaningless. But what happens is you get the implementation of psychology and psychoanalytics and the promotion by the Rockefellers of liberation theology and its more Americanized version of the social gospel. And what this is just the movement of getting away from all the old archaic theological debates and ideas and moving it into more of a humanitarian NGO type operation. And that's once again why it would be useful to Rockefellers or intelligence agencies, is that you can begin to use Protestant missionaries and these kinds of groups as foreign operatives or for foreign social engineering operations. And that's what unfortunately begins to happen. I'm sure some people would say that, this has been the case with Christianity all along. I don't buy that because, for one, you look, say, at these old ecumenical councils, and they're decreeing things that are not advantageous to the state. And a lot of people died. A lot of emperors tried to get things through that would have destroyed the church and given them controllership of the church, whether East or West, which they did not succeed in. So I don't see Christianity as like some giant conspiracy of the state or secret families or something like that. I think it was, history is complex. There's a lot of different factors, but in the 20th century, it really comes down to the oligarchs, these families, these groups, these interests wanting to take over the religions and use them for social engineering. And that's unfortunately what I think has happened. And the same is true of Orthodoxy too, for in large part, you do have a lot of resistance. In fact, this is even happening now as the ecumenical patriarch, who many believe has now capitulated and is probably some sort of Mason or heretic. The ecumenical patriarch is pushing for the Orthodox version of Vatican II. You could probably say the Orthodox world is split down the middle, roughly, opposing this. What you see is that it's the same pattern. So everything that they're trying, that they did at Vatican II, they're now trying to push and say, oh, all of Orthodoxy has got to accept, all the ecumenism, and oh, it's going to be so great. But what we see is that it's the exact same results. It leads to the same drastic drops in conversions, drops in baptisms, drops in people entering into seminary, drops in convents, drops in monasteries. It's just had totally deleterious effects in the West for the Roman Catholic Church. It will be absolutely no different for Orthodoxy in the East. So, yeah, it's bad news all around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the key points in history in the West, I think, is there's a painting I have of the Bishop of Milan reproving the Emperor Theodosius.
Yes.
Trying to emperor the Milan Cathedral, and he's telling the bishop... He's forcing the bishop the emperor to back down,
right?
And symbolizing the power of the church versus the power of the state,
right?
Same thing people do also do with missionary work. There's a tendency of people to kind of like, oh, missionaries are just doing the work of imperialism, and in many cases it's true. But also there were genuine missionary missions out there. They were looking to uplift and improve the lives of native people, of indigenous populations. I just did an interview with E. Michael Jones about a month ago, and in his book, Barren Metal, he talks about the efforts of the Jesuits in Paraguay.
Yeah, I heard it. Yeah.
And just a good example. And of course, they were too successful. And so, strange enough, is that the people that conspired against the Jesuits were Freemason agents.
Yep.
In Portugal and in France. And of course, one of the harshest critics of the Jesuits was Voltaire, who was a British agent, most likely.
Right. And people think that this is all fake and staged, and that all the Jesuits were all Mason. That's not true. This is not. I mean, you have many of these people have died over this stuff.
Yeah.
Been martyred.
And there's a movie called
The. I mean, how many Jesuits did the Anglican schismatics kill? How many Catholics did they kill? These awful British kings.
Yeah, and that's all part of the Black Legend, Leandro Negro, the Black Legend. So history is complicated, and so there's a lot of woolly talk out there about Jesuits running the world and Jesuits this, Jesuits that, and I think E. Michael Jones said the criticism of the old Jesuits is more applicable to the new Jesuits.
Yeah, well, see, this is what, and this is what we get even admitted by Martin, was that the oligarchs totally took that thing over.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue that it was actually the Jesuits that were the revolutionary force in the 20th century in totally altering the landscape of Roman Catholicism.
But that would go in line with your analysis and others' analysis of Freemasonic infiltration.
Yes, the Alta Vendita, and this is one of the, there's 13, 10, 11, 12, 13 encyclicals back to 1700s condemning and warning about Masonic infiltration. By the way, there's a bunch of those same warnings and patriarchal letters and so forth in Orthodoxy as well about Masonic infiltration.
And we have, in the run-up to Vatican II, I think you had the crisis with Pius XII, who was ill for a long time. So there was sort of effective vacancy in the papal office leading up to the election of John the 23rd, who some people think was elected, getting into Vatican intrigues here. Right, was it he some people dispute his election, John the 23rd?
Yeah, a lot of these guys are disputed, but more disputed than John the 23rd is the election of Paul the Sixth.
Paul the Sixth, so, okay.
Yeah, if I recall, the notion was that when actually Martin supports this thesis, it's called the Cardinal Siri thesis, that it was actually supposed to be Cardinal Siri, who would have been a little more on the conservative reform side, and he was not allowed to take the office. That's possible. I don't really know. That you get lost in all these kind of theories, and then some people think that there's two different Paul the Sixes. So I don't know, but I do think there's probably something to the assassination of John Paul I theory. Now, that doesn't mean that necessarily John Paul I would have been a great guy. He would have continued the ecumenical stuff, but mm-hmm. that relates more to the Vatican Bank scandal and whatever was going on there. So, but I tend to think that he probably was assassinated, and that that does tie into Masonry and the P2 Lodge and all that. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many documents. You have to read Leo XIII's encyclical, Humanum Genus. That's the one that really most expansively lays out the Masonic plot. And you have the story of Cardinal Rampolla, who was OTO, who was almost elected to the office of the papacy, supposedly, and that was halted back at that time, whenever that was, late 1890s, somewhere in there. And I believe that's how Leo XIII got it, was because they almost got this OTO guy elected. I don't know if that's true, but that's supposedly. But then you have the a lot. Cardinal Belo is reported to, whispered to have associations with the OTO. There was accusations that Cardinal Roncalli or John XXIII, that he was actually a Rosicrucian. Hard to know if any of that's true, but you will see these strange indications at times, like having a wooden casket. That's actually a Masonic thing. Why would John XXIII choose a wooden casket? Oh, well, it's because he was just so pious. Well, maybe. Or was he giving homage to Freemasonry? I mean, you know, he works with a lot of these Marxists and communists, worker priests. He's doesn't want Vatican II to condemn communism. He writes Pacem in Terris, which is this encyclical that deals with creating a global market. Basically, the global market needs to be controlled by global financial regulatory means. It's basically almost, it's warmed over communism, like watered down communism is what a lot of people have charged that document with. And I don't say that because I'm just saying, oh, we got to have a free market. I am saying that given John the 23rd's associations and his close connections to Khrushchev he loved a lot of these so-called communist guys. It's entirely possible that he really believed this view. Now he could have still just been a total stooge of, you know, Western intelligence. But he doesn't seem to be that. Most people, I have some biographies of John the 23rd, and he's not a great intellect. I'll put it that way. You know, people who defend him say, well, he was just a humble man, you know? So if he's a simpleton, then he's just being duped and used. Or if he's nefarious and he was really a Rosicrucian, then, you know, he had an agenda, and, you know, he was part of the Masonic plot to destroy this entity. And I don't see any difference between like the Masonic plot and, you know, Western CIA plots. Mm-hmm. To me, they mesh well because, you know, it goes back to the whole British imperial ideology.
Now, the significance of the papal office in particular, and the Catholic Church in general, you made a point in your talk that a lot of people don't consider the importance of the Catholic mm-hmm. Church geopolitically. But Malachy Martin says that this was John Paul II's, main emphasis during his papacy.
It's the most important aspect because it's the largest influential body of religious belief. I mean, even Islam is not yet, I don't think, to a billion, roughly. But even with the declining numbers of Roman Catholicism, it's still the largest numbers-wise global institution in terms of this kind of influence. Mm-hmm. So you could see why, if you are the Western oligarchic elite, this is a problem. You know, this is a kind of thing that you got to take over and you got to run. And you know, now that we know and we can look back on these revolutionary movements, right? The French Revolution, the Protestant Revolution, any of the cultic hermetic groups, the Rosicrucians and all these idiots, these different groups, Voltaire, Diderot, the Illuminists, the Jacobins, on and on and on and on and on. What do they all dislike? They dislike Christianity. They dislike this kind of Christianity.
Yeah,
it's just that simple.
And we get a lot of rhetoric today. I think you could say the Jacobins themselves were sort of an outgrowth of Illuminism.
Exactly, they were. That's what I believe totally. I think that's actually documented. And but what I'm trying to say is that the situation for us today is not much different. It's just worse insofar as you still have the ideology. You've got all these just armies of the social justice warrior types out there, these kinds of people who they could be the rough analogs of the Jacobins or the communists or whatever. They're not communists. They don't know anything about that. But they're basically just serving that function. And above them is the oligarchs. And, you know, that's why I'm rambling, but what I'm trying to say is that they're part and parcel with death.
Yeah.
It's a culture of death. And I think that was an accurate term, because the more I think about it, the more you see how evil works as you get older, you see that it's self-destructive, and it's not just self-destructive, but it's also self-destructive to societies as a whole. So euthanasia and abortion and all these things, you start to realize are tools and weapons of genocide. And then you have these armies of the brainwashed people who adopt it and don't and can't understand that it's all self-destructive. And so the only thing in my mind that can explain that is not merely some lack of education, you know, some sort of behaviorist or Pelagian view of trying to explain these things, but rather that, you know, men are dealing with actual real evil, you know?
Yeah.
And what evil tries to do is to get men to destroy themselves and their offspring.
And they do that by telling that you too shall, you know, shall be gods. That goes back to the Garden of Eden, I guess. That the grand deception.
It could have been with Martin too, that, you know, maybe he was a guy who, you know, maybe he vacillated in his views over time, and then maybe by the time he was a matured older guy who saw the ins and outs of all this, he just felt like, man, you know, this is so vast, this conspiracy, you know, like,
yeah,
maybe he capitulated.
He seemed to be an agent. Like anything, just because you're an agent doesn't necessarily mean you have evil intent or you know the whole picture. You're more or less giving orders and you're told what to do and you're given a certain amount of rewards for doing it.
Well, there's accusations, and I don't know if any of it's true, and I'm not trying to defame him as a person in an ad hominem way, but just speaking in terms of, you know, what we know about blackmail, you know, he supposedly had an affair or two. Maybe he was blackmailed. Maybe they told him, you know, you're going to do what we say, because the accusation is he was with somebody's wife or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was Kaiser, the guy who wrote the book Clerical Errors. He was a reporter during the Vatican II. His wife was with him. He claims that Malachi Martin had an affair with his wife, and apparently he had an appetite for women.
Right.
Which means he compromised.
Yes, that comes up in Hushes to the Devil, if in fact he is the priest in these stories, that's admitted in Hostage to the Devil. So now I'm talking about the appetite for women. So point being, just again, I have no idea if any of that's true. I don't really care ultimately in the long run. It's just, it's only germane insofar as it could suggest him being blackmailed.
Yeah, and just same thing I've heard of reports regarding Cardinal Spellman.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Rothstein, the detective in New York, claims that Rothstein was compromised by Rory Cohn.
Right. Yeah, I heard you talk about that.
So, I mean, so, and that's when it gets to some of these church sex scandals. To the what extent is it just the church not being immune to the overall, you know, cultural changes that are going on in the 60s and 70s, and
right. The
church being polluted by the polluted, you know, cultural well, societal well? Mm-hmm. That's what the church draws from, or it seems to be like a more sinister, like Malachi Martin suggested that you had, you know, satanic rites being performed, and so that's a little different.
Well, what's interesting is that he says that the height of the rites of the fallen angels is the pedophilia, mm-hmm. and the rich pedophilia. So that's his claim, and you know, whatever we do with that, it is interesting nowadays, you know, 2017, looking back and what all's come out, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, that does, it does suggest or lend a lot more credence to that kind of a view. And, like you were saying with the web guy, you know, that would be serious blackmail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Being involved in that kind of stuff. You know, if you like kids, you know, you're in serious blackmail territory.
And that's where all this got started, with the surveillance, with the intelligence agencies, with MK Ultra and George Hunter White, his Operation Midnight Climax.
Midnight Climax, you know, right.
Yeah. It's all about sexual compromise, and society got more liberal and more degraded. You know, a simple, rendezvous with a prostitute or a love affair isn't enough to ruin someone's reputation anymore, because no one seems to care about that stuff anymore. So you have
you had to up the ante. Right?
You have to up the ante. So there's a certain, sinister logic to it all. And then, of course, there's always money involved in it, because there's a business behind it. So that would seem to suggest that the two go in tandem, I guess you could. But yeah, there is something ritual with with child sex abuse, and also infant child sacrifice, with the satanic rites. And you get some of these reports, you know, whether it's the Pizzagate thing or the Franklin scandal, you have that theme running through it too, where you have not just homosexuals' love for teenage boys or young or adolescents. You're getting into some reports of some child sacrifice
In Program to Kill, Dave McGowan talks about several different cases that were at least reported in mainstream news or local news sources. For example, in Italy, you had the case of this guy who was reported to be very wealthy and running in elite circles, and was involved in human sacrifice for occult reasons.
Yeah,
that was in the 90s, maybe. Yeah. Maybe it's back towards the Berkowitz era, but it's in the section where Dave is talking about Berkowitz and the possibility of other killers in relationship to Zodiac, and that they might be contract hits. But he says that there is in these cases sometimes that satanic element, and that's because these are networks, right? And trafficking in secrets. And the Vatican's chief exorcist, Amorth, he's talked about this for many, many decades, basically backing up the claims of Martin. And I was just looking the other day through Google News, and if you change up the wordings that you use in your searches, and you can find quite a few of these stories that still pop up and still come about. I found an article that listed like 10 recent cases in the last 10 cases in the last 10 years or something like that, that dealt with ritualized human sacrifices. And in a lot of cases, it appears to be, again, if the mainstream stories that are linked here are legitimate, appears to be like cases of immigrants, you know, like somebody from maybe Sri Lanka or India, who still holds to perhaps some kind of older Hindu tradition or something like that, and they're angry at somebody, and they believe that they need to sacrifice a child or something like this. But in other cases, in the article that I've stumbled upon, there were situations of people in what appear to be higher class situations. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wealthy type sacrifice pedophilia circles, not just the primitive, immigrant type superstition.
Yeah, and you get this whole idea of the blood, that you get the chemical in the blood, it gives you a high. What is that?
The high. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, it's weird. Yeah. And again, it's not so much that it may be true, it's just that they believe it. And that's what you get in these.
Well, if you read about the serial killers, they talk about it that way.
Yeah.
Now, again, I've never drank blood, so I don't know if it's true, but even perhaps if it's not, let's say for the sake of argument, it doesn't give you some great high or something like that. For the people who have mental problems or spiritual problems or pathologies or fetishes and obsessions, to them, they can experience it that way, or they may believe or feel that it is necessary for them.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. Yeah, and that's what you see in a lot of these cases of the serial killers who maybe they were abused or something, and then they feel like they have this, compelling need to do this, and maybe they hear voices, which this is a common thing that you read about in those cases. Well, I was hearing the voices, and the voices wouldn't stop unless they, unless I ate a human or drank blood or something like that.
Yeah.
So, who knows what all the different causes might be, but I do think this happens.
Mm-hmm. So now with,
I've mentioned this before. We've had cases locally of this, not necessarily like high profile people, but, maybe drug related groups that kidnap people and torture them. We've had some cases of that around here, especially because Tennessee is a meth area. And some of these people are very, very nasty, vicious people. And we've also had the sparse, I would say every 10 years you get the satanic ritual case that pops up in Tennessee. You have the West Memphis case. You have the Murray vampire killers and others. So these kind of stories do pop up.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that type of attitude exists in, say, less, affluent circles.
Right.
Yes. You can see it inhabiting, rich circles. And that's...
Were talking about Eli Roth and, his claim about hostile type stuff and people hunting people. If you remember Dave's book, the last chapter of Program to Kill is about Jean Baudel Bokassa. And he was the French puppet. He crowned himself emperor of Africa.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he liked to eat people.
Yeah, the Central African Republic or something? Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, also with the Marc Dutroux affair, these things, of course, that didn't involve cannibalism, but he was procuring women, young girls, I think, primarily.
Well, if I recall, Crowley says that he supports the practice of, if you look at the Congo or Haiti or these kinds of places or Rhodesia, what the warlords do is they have the older, animistic or voodoo type belief that when you conquer your enemy, that you take in their power by eating either their brain. If you eat their brain, you're taking in their intelligence. If you eat their heart, you're taking in their power.
Mm-hmm.
That is the, animistic pagan type view. Now, so you get Western occult writers who support that view and they say, this is what you need to do if you want to, increase your power or whatever. And then you find these articles that come out in mainstream news. I'm not making this up. Where like the Kardashians are getting, I'm not joking. Well, the claim at least is the article's claim. Blood facials, and this is where you get the blood from young teenagers or young people who, in these cases, supposedly donate it. And this is like a trend, and this keeps your skin young, right? The blood of young people is good for Kim Kardashian to have a pretty face. I'm not joking. That sounds crazy. You can look it up. Blood transfusion facials is a real thing. And so, this again, not what I'm getting at is just a hop, skip and a jump away from eating it.
Yeah. And of course you may have to procure that blood through involuntary means.
Exactly.
And with, so many, surplus pork people, useless eaters out there. You can more than enough people you can draw the blood from. I mean, you get that I did a number of talks, George, regarding organ harvesting.
And yes.
It sounds sensational as you start really thinking about the logic behind it, the business model behind it. And he's talking about the human body being worth anywhere $1 to $5 million.
Yes, right.
And so you go to a country like Haiti or maybe the south side of Chicago.
Exactly.
You know, and you have all these, you know, a situation that's destabilized or unstable, and you within that instability, you can kill people without any questions being asked and have the organs harvested. And the, mm-hmm. the strange patterns of people being shot with none of the organs are affected. You know, you notice these patterns. And if you think that's, you know, that never would happen. Well, yeah, if it's worth that much, if the market has a demand for something and there's so many transplants being done and there's a difference between the amount of available organs and the number of transplants being performed. How do you reconcile that?
Well, if they sell babies, I mean, why is any of this other stuff hard to believe?
Yeah, Planned Parenthood, it sells baby parts. Okay, and you know, so how is this any different? Really, it's not. I was listening to a podcast a couple of weeks ago about a 16-year-old boy who shot himself in the head. I think he was playing with a gun or something, looking at it, shot himself, and he wasn't dead. So he was just severely injured. So the parents called the EMTs. They came, ambulance came, took him to the hospital. And the doctor told him there's nothing they could do. He's an organ donor because he's 16 years old, you know, all that stuff. So they pressured them to sign off on the organs because his organs mm-hmm. were so young and valuable. Well, to make a long story short, they found out that in the ambulance they had to drug him, sedate him because he was resisting intubation, meaning he was alert.
Right, right.
Okay, so he gets to the hospital and the doctor immediately says nothing we can do for him, and so. They leave the hospital. They find out later on that the kid was kept alive for 19 hours, so the organs could be harvested. The fact of the matter is, you can't harvest organs from a dead person.
Yeah.
So there's right. an inherent ethical, moral problem with organ harvesting.
That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've developed legal fictions like brain dead to justify it. But what's scary here is what this case suggests is, here, 16-year-old boy, athlete. A gunshot wound to the head. Okay, this case all of a sudden, the fact that he's 16, he's all that. This gets the system working, and it suggests that from the doctors all the way down to the EMTs, they're trained to harvest organs as opposed to saving the patient if he meets certain parameters.
Yes, and this is Milgram experiment type stuff. Yes. Yeah. Yeah,
and then and there's a business model too because it's worth so much to the hospital.
Yes, yes, I remember. I first heard about some of that kind of stuff and looked into the organ harvesting stuff. I decided I will never ever mark that on my driver's license that I'm an organ donor, and I never have. I also even like before I even knew any of the conspiracy stuff. I remember back in high school, everybody would go and give blood. Mm-hmm. And I'm not I don't know anything even about a conspiracy related to blood donor, but I just assumed it's just something about it always seemed off to me. Like, I mean, maybe it is, good to give blood. I'm not saying it's always wrong, but I just something about it's always seemed weird to me of giving blood. So I've never done it. And, I'd have no idea. What are they doing with this blood? I have no idea. Is this going into a DNA lab somewhere for, who knows? I don't trust Red Cross has been implicated in all kinds of scams anyway. So, I've just always, I've never been a fan of any of that kind of stuff.
So, it's creepy stuff, but it's chilling because you realize, but it's a business model approach to these things. It's kind of like, it doesn't, you think about it, it makes sense because these organs, whether it's blood, blood plasma, heart, these things are worth a lot of money. And if you can get them on the cheap, and apparently that's what they, if you can go in and destabilize a country, okay, and
you have actuaries for how much the people would be worth, right?
Yeah.
We've got 43 million worth of organs here. Yeah.
The same way you covet the oil beneath the soil,
exactly.
the land, or the fresh water, or the gold, or the mineral rights, human beings are they're very valuable. if you can grind them down and render them down and into some sort of product, they'll do it.
Right.
And, you know, that's their
philosophy. And this is that whole, yeah, that whole predatory parasitic obsession with quantification that views everything in this kind of, you know, commodity way that, how do we traffic in all this? By the way, it reminds me of, I didn't know this. I thought I knew quite a bit about conspiracy world stuff and, I mean, real conspiracy stuff. I had no idea that they use the aborted stem cell stuff for vaccines. And that's true. Could you believe that? I did not know that. I knew about the Pepsi stuff. And so I went down this rabbit hole. I was looking into Sonomics and their genetic stuff and how they use what does it mean to say that Pepsi uses the stem cell for flavoring, right? Well, it turns out when you start looking into it, they don't tell you because this is their secret recipe process. We don't actually know what they're doing, but they do admit that, yes, there is this one cell supposedly from the aborted fetus that's used in a lot of these different things and is cloned or something supposedly. And so even, you know, this has come up like in the Vatican ethics questions, and the Vatican's even had a statement on what the Catholic process is for the use for vaccine usage of aborted fetal cell vaccines. And they even list all the companies that use it and don't. And so we don't know what we're eating now. I'm just going to step into speculation land for a second here, which I've been wondering. So we've been told through science fiction, you know, Soylent Green and stuff, that we might be fed people. Now, we know what happens if you eat people. This is the dangerous part of it, is Kuru disease, or people develop, you know, sort of dementia and these strange diseases. And we see this when cows, for example, that are not carnivores, when they're fed the ground up dead cow, they develop mad cow disease, or at least the story is. Now I wonder if you were weaponizing things and you did want to secretly, you know, attack the population, you know, who knows, maybe we are being fed, you know, people. I know that may sound out there, and I'm just speculating, but, you know, maybe that's one of the easiest ways to genetically attack people. I wouldn't be surprised given all this other stuff.
Well, H.G. Wells wrote about the atomic bomb in a sci-fi story. You know, that's the Soylent Green.
Of course, Green stuff, right.
From what I understand, the Soylent Green, the eating of people, wasn't in the book, but it was in the movie.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I haven't read it.
James Corbett did a thing on Soylent Green, and that's one of the things that,
For
some reason, the movie includes that in the book. The book's more about the cover up of a murder, the official cover up of, and the how the power, more or less how the power elite manipulate this in an investigation into the murder of one of their own, because he was going against the grain, or going against the consensus.
Well, the AP reported a few years ago, and again, that doesn't mean that's necessarily true, but there was at least a public report of, I believe from China, that. Pills that were dead babies.
Well, I mean, if you're going to rely on these large corporations to supply your food, how are you going to keep track of what's in it? People don't know what's in it anyway. I mean, think of it. I mean, we get used to it. It's like McDonald's or Burger King, or this food that has a shelf life of 75 years. Should you be eating it? I mean, if nature doesn't break it down in 75 years, should you be eating it?
Well, this is the Atlantic, which I'm not saying that the Atlantic is necessarily credible, but probably a little bit more believable than maybe the Daily Mail or something. But the Atlantic, horrifyingly, the ground baby pill thing is real. And this is the disturbing news out of South Korea, that since August, officials have found 17,000 pills filled with human flesh, in particular the placenta and ground up bodies of dead Chinese babies. This is supposed to be the story, at least. Now, I don't know what this would be for, unless that there's this trend that people think, you know, like Kim Kardashian getting blood on her face, like this helps you look young or something.
Eating young or something, maintain your stamina or something.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But that's the same method behind cell stem research. And
yes, exactly.
You know, whereas you can make someone healthy by killing somebody. And But that's the same ethic behind sort of the neoliberal approach to these things. It's
well, it's just we're all animals. It's all Darwinism, you know, predator to prey, right?
The Newtonian system, basically.
Well, this is what the psychopathics, if it's real, you know, when psychopath serial killers talk about this stuff, what are they always saying? You know, I'm the apex predator.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. It's
why not eat people? You know, I mean, aside from the Kuru disease you might get, or mad cow disease or something, like, why not?
Yes, survival of the fittest. That's sort of excuse for this. But I mean, that gets, we're talking about Malachi Martin and the church, and Chris, we're dealing with Vatican too. But it seems to suggest the you know, the gradual corruption of the church began long before Vatican II.
Correct.
I mean, some say it dates back. Well, you know, you have the they started to give a little bit on usury back in the I guess that was the 17th century, and some have said that the Renaissance itself and the Enlightenment was the application of I don't know if this is accurate or not, but basically it was the injection of the Kabbalah into Christianity, which.
There's some truth to it.
Yeah, but you see, it's probably a little broad, but I can see how somebody would make that statement.
And this is kind of, you know, this is the Michael Hoffman analysis.
Yeah.
And it's the argument that this was the big flaw of allowing usury and this kind of stuff. I think that it's more than just usury. I think you had to have other, you know, theological precepts. I mean, I'm not saying he's saying this, but I'm saying that there had to be other, I think, philosophical and theological problems at work that would have allowed for that to be as well. But yes, there's some truth to this, absolutely, because this is where you get the big banking houses, and there is some fuzzy connection between Florence and the Medicis and then the rise of, you know, the banking empires of Europe.
And of course you have alchemy,
mm-hmm.
which alchemy was always sold to as sort of a way to you know, to create wealth out of nothing.
Yes, Martin's chapter on all of that is actually pretty good. I've been very critical of him, but he is pretty good in outlining the history. It's, I believe, chapter 28. This whole history of Masonry in Europe is a pretty good outline, and he talks about everything that you're talking about and how, yeah, you have at one point this you know, guild of Catholic tradesmen, and then at some point I don't think anybody really knows, this, you know, melded into the adoption of specular Freemasonry and the speculations of alchemy and Kabbalism and so he's good on all that, and he actually charts the rise of, I think he says, in, you know, like the 1500s there was, I don't know, some low number of lodges, and then by, you know, like 100 years later there was like just this explosion of lodges of speculative Freemasonry throughout Europe, and that it had attracted many of the nobility. Now you say, well, why would that be if Masonry is, you know, against throne and altar? Well, Masonry is different levels of subterfuge and con artistry.
Mm-hmm.
So now if you're a prince and you see the Reformation starting to, you know, gain sway in Europe, you might want to link up with Luther. Who did Luther go to? He went to the German princes to link up with them, because Luther presumed that he could probably find common ground with, you know, men of the state who didn't want this annoying Pope telling them what to do. So we've talked about that before, but so Martin's good, pretty good on all that, and he gets into the history of Grand Orient Masonry and all that.
Well, that's the big thing, was the English Reformation and the rise of the lodge in I guess the early 18th century in Britain, and the Whig ascendancy, and how they kind of they glummed on to Freemasonry as a technique for imperialism.
Interestingly, though, Martin, what I've never seen anybody else do is Martin will go back into the history of a lot of this stuff in Poland. Now, this probably gets into Belgium and the territory that Hoffman deals with Rabbi Jacob Lowe and the Golem mythology there.
Mm-hmm.
And Prague, okay, and then but I've not, I haven't really seen anybody treat what was going on in Poland. And the reason that Martin does this, again, this is why he does it. I'm not saying this is all true, but it is because he's interested in the bloodline of John Paul II. He's interested in the genealogy and where he comes from and the history of Poland. And Martin makes this argument that Poland was one of the first European movements towards secular Republican government. And he tries to argue that this is kind of in some mystical way, like the impetus behind a lot of this, masonry. And he talks about even the Jews that were in Poland at that time. And this is like page 5, 14, 15, somewhere in there. Yeah.
So they're the first to kind of adopt the pluralism approach to these things. And
he calls it the Piast Pact of 990.
990. Okay. So,
yeah.
Okay. Wow. So it's going.
He's not necessarily saying that that's all Masonic. He's saying that this is kind of like a Polish version of Magna Carta.
Okay.
Maybe.
I see. Okay.
Ideas of limiting, you know, rulers and this kind of stuff. And then he talks about pages 5, 18 and 19. He talks about Reformation and the explosion of Masonry. But yeah, he links the first Polish Republic, 17. Let's see. Yeah, they're called pacts, and I don't know the history of Poland, so like this was.
Yeah, I know.
This is all new to me, but yeah, it's page 5, 16 and 17 is where he links all this to the history of Poland and why John Paul might be relevant in that regard, because he was Polish, of course. But yeah, there's apparently all these different, they're called PACTs, P-A-C-T-S, the Polish PACTs.
Yeah, I'm looking at the chapter right now. PACTs of Extinction.
Mm-hmm.
The PACTs of Extinction, the death of atonement of the first Polish Republic. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I got to get to this book.
And if you go back on page 514, he talks about the Piast Pact of 990, it had a wondrous effect, and it allowed for religious toleration of dozens of religions, he says. I believe that's what he's saying here, yeah.
And could this have effect?
Could be seen in the Poland in the 16th century. So he's arguing that Poland was kind of this pioneer of ecumenism in a way, and religious tolerance that could be seen in the 16th century.
Yeah. Wow.
And then he says, you know, this is a tradition. So I don't know. Is maybe John Paul II was a secret Jewish agent? I don't know.
Well, too, because I mean, same. That's interesting because John Paul II became an advocate of the Assisi thing, the ecumenical meeting.
Oh yeah, I mean he took it to like a whole new level.
Yeah,
that nobody else had.
So that's interesting. So he's suggesting that. John Paul II's Wattia's bloodline might date back to that going on in Poland back in the.
Yeah, he's speculating, but yes.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Well. Mm-hmm. So, but well.
And he is talking about. I mean, the title of the book is telling you that. Like, he's talking about bloodlines and blood in different levels, different senses. So he's partly talking about, you know, the blood of Jesus, and he's also talking about the office of the papacy, but he's also talking about people's genealogy.
Mm-hmm. So as far as your typical Catholic church goer, what should be the takeaway from all this? I mean, he goes to church, he makes sure his kids receive the sacraments, and, and the fact that it's obviously something's going on. I mean, anyone who's familiar with church history knows that it's a mixed history. It's a 2,000-year-old institution, and there's been some good times and bad times, and some very bad decisions made by popes over the years regarding their alliances and what they should, you know, who they should side with. And but as far as the state of the papacy today, we have Pope Francis, who has many people dismayed. Mm-hmm. What are we to take from all this? As a I mean, it's hard for many people to reconcile, because I know a lot of people who have, they don't have many kind words to say for the current Pope, but that, that's usually done from a right-wing, American right-wing perspective.
Well, I think he's awful. I think it's very sad. You know, I don't, I'm not happy for what's happened in Western Christianity, be it Protestant or Catholic. I mean, and I recognize you're going to have problems anywhere you go, but mm-hmm. I mean, I've been thinking about that very question a lot lately, what you're asking. And I just don't think you can get away from the responsibility that we have as individuals, even to learn these things and to be responsible and care for our friends and family. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around that. You can't just pass it off to, oh, well, that's what the preacher does. Oh, that's what the priests and the bishops do. And I just, it's just my duty. I mean, you can't take that lazy approach. It would be nice if, you know, we lived maybe in a better time or period, but we can't, we just don't have that liberty or luxury because of how dangerous a lot of these people can be. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you, let's say you had a homosexual minister or a minister who was questionable, you know, I would be wary of letting my kids be around that guy. And I'm not just talking about in a Roman Catholic setting. And I'm not knocking all that. I've met many Catholic priests that I respect and I think well of. And the same goes in the Orthodox world. There's a lot of scoundrels there too, and sickos and compromised people. I'm just saying that we have to be wary and be wise. You know, what does Jesus say? Be wise as serpents, right? Mm-hmm. And innocent as doves. So we have to, we can never shirk the responsibility that we have to educate ourselves. And that's even part of traditional theology, whether East or West. You have the responsibility as an individual to know your Bible and to know the theology of the church. That's not the duty of the priest, and it's not Protestant to say that you're supposed to know your Bible. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody teaches. The church fathers all teach that.
Yeah. It's it'd be nice if you could rely on righteous leadership.
It would be nice, but unfortunately that is not the time in which we live.
And that's another thing is, I think I've made this remark before, but a lot of people will look at the church, the state of the church, and just point fingers at the church, but don't look at their own lives or their own community. The polluted culture that we've all not just been a victim of, but acquiesced to in many ways. Many people will consume the popular culture, mindlessly watch, you know, the popular entertainment and music, and not think that it's having this you know, sort of this negative alchemical effect on us, but it is. It's so much so that we don't even recognize it anymore because we're so degraded that we can't recognize right. our own you know, degraded state. But the church itself draws from the general community, and all the agents of liberalism, mm-hmm. They're advocating all this free love stuff, all this stuff. Then they, when the church has a scandal, it proves that she is not immune to the winds of change in society, the immune to all the, you know, the free love and drugs and sex right. and all this stuff, then that no one takes ownership for that. The New York Times doesn't take ownership for the sex scandals, although they're the ones advocating open homosexuality, transgenderism. What do you think it's going to have the effect? These things don't, you know, you can't keep these things isolated, and that's right. the reason why they're promoted. You know.
Yes, exactly. It has a leavening effect. You know, Jesus says that.
Yeah. You know, you can't, you know, you're not going to find, you're not going to have a lot of, you know, of righteous young men who want to become priests in a society that's so degraded.
Right.
You know, and that's like the, what E. Michael Jones makes the point with the Boston Globe, where the very priests that were caught in the sex scandals you know, under Cardinal Bernard Law, were priests that were, years before, were praised for their innovative youth outreach by the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
And yeah. the Boston Globe doesn't mention that, you know. And then when the priest, I think it was the Vatican, says that homosexuals shouldn't be ordained. The Boston right. Globe, New York Times, says they're bigoted and they're old-fashioned and they're, you know, narrow-minded. You know, okay. So which is it, you know? You know. And So you can't promote these things. You can't promote, you know, these things in the movies and the music and these things and not expect it to have an effect. And, you know, so.
Well, that's all I have on. I can't. I want to be fair to the subscribers. I don't want to, you know, give away too much of what was or two. But, you know, I personally, I wouldn't go so far as to recommend the book. For one, it's 700 pages. Most people are not going to read that.
No.
You know, if you really want to, you can read it. But, you know, it's just another demonstration, I guess, of the difficulty in all areas of Christianity in the 20th century. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Protestant or whether you're Orthodox or whether you're Catholic. The takeaway from it is that the real bad guys, you know, have put their fingers and their tentacles into the church for a long time and are trying to use it for the purpose of, you know, social engineering and global government. And the best way to oppose that is to be responsible for yourself and to not give in to ecumenism. I mean, that's going to be the main weapon. And I forget who I was reading or something. Somebody was saying, I forget who it was, but it was they were making the point that the argument, the weapon is going to be, maybe it was Huxley, but if you say you're distinct or correct, you're going to be the problem.
Hmm.
You see. So any claims to exclusivity, right? If you claim, you know, my church is correct, this proposition is true, this belief is correct, this one is false. You know, these claims of exclusivity are going to be considered the problem in the future.
Which is why all institutions, whether it's you want to maintain like an all-male institution or an ethnic neighborhood.
All of those things, yes.
Have to be smashed, and they're all done in the name of progressivism, of justice. Social justice.
Exactly.
Ecumenism. It's kind of like a globalism is ecumenism. You know, it's applied ecumenism, I guess you could say. And, you know, today, you know, now just the claim that there's a distinction between male and female is considered, you know, is no longer objective.
Exactly. Right. Because those are claims of exclusivity and limitation.
Yeah.
And definition. Right.
It's like being able to say 2 plus 2 equals 4. No, it's the party says it's 5, and
right.
It's, you know, it's objective reality. Yeah,
exactly. I think I'm gonna have to call it an evening. I'm kind of
I'll let you go.
A couple talks earlier, but it's been a good talk.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. I'll let you
Thank
go.
Thank you. I always learn from you.
Yes. Well, this was that's a heavy book, and that's there's a heavy talk. So
yeah,
I recommend people go listen to it, and if they like it, subscribe because there's another hour to it, which is well worth the listen.
I don't think I'm unfair to you know other views, Catholic or Protestant. I'm trying to analyze you know what Martin's book claims and you know what the takeaway is from that.
No. It's a great lecture, and you know because I'm Catholic, and it does as I'm trying to sort you know these things out. Trying to understand what's happening. And it is. It helped me out a lot trying to think of what's going on in the church, and as opposed to just shutting down, saying don't worry about it. You know, the good times, bad times, and you know maybe we'll get a good pope again. And it's not like it's you know, like we'll get another president elected or something. It was a great talk. If you want to listen to the whole talk, you can just. You can subscribe to Jay's analysis for what, $4.95 a month, $60 a year?
Correct, right.
Yeah. And I do recommend people do that because this type of analysis you don't get anywhere else. And it's added value.
Right. Next, I think we will do a Program to Kill. And again, you know, my analyses are commentary. They're not a substitution for the book. I always recommend the book if people want to get it. You know, so I'm not trying to take away from Dave's, you know, family's income or whatever. So,
No. I think Dave would be happy to have someone do that. Mm-hmm. I'll have to talk to you after you do that. We'll have to talk about that. That'd be great.
Plus a lot of people, if I talk about a movie or a book, quite a few people actually go watch it or buy it. So,
Oh yeah. I mean,
so it actually helps. I think it helps people. I'm not robbing them.
I've seen a few movies based on your recommendation or your reviews. So, mm-hmm. Yes, it's definitely the case. Okay, well, Jay, I'll let you go. It's late.
All right, Tim.
And so, listen, we'll talk again soon, maybe later this spring or early this summer, when you get the when you expect the Program to Kill thing to come out.
I'm hoping to do that in the next few days.
Oh, okay.
Maybe because I haven't done a subscribers thing in about a week, so.
Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll talk to you sooner than I think. I don't know.
All right.
Because I'll give it a listen. That's great. So,
right.
Okay, cool. Listen, enjoy your weekend. Take care. I'll probably post this probably over the weekend. I'll send you the link.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Great. Take it easy. Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.